And boom.
Click on one more time. One more time.
Sometimes I want to break out into hallelujah chorus.
Okay.
Last week, we ran out of time as we got through the last few verses of chapter 17. So I don't want to rehash chapter 17, but I want to quickly go over the last few verses to put us back into context about chapter 17. It's going to be quick, because I think we've already done the detail. But let's start out back in chapter 17, verse 12. It says, "And the 10 horns which you saw are 10 kings who have not yet received a kingdom." And that means it's 10 kings of the future. Now we're going to see later on in this chapter that these 10 kings attack the harlot. So I still think that it's 10 kings of the future, because it says they have not yet received a kingdom. But I'm also speculating, and I'm speculating now, clearly admit that, I'm speculating that these are 10 kings that came into power during the declining years of the Roman Empire. Because it wouldn't make any sense for 10 kings 5,000 years later to be attacking the Roman Empire, because there was no Roman Empire 5,000 years later. So y'all see what I'm getting at? So these 10 kings were around as the Roman Empire was deteriorating to make war on it. But they had not yet come into power yet. So it's probably people that weren't even born yet. Okay. 13. These have one purpose, and they gave their power and authority to the beast. Well, that tells us that they're evil, because they gave their power and authority to the beast. And we know where the beast got his power. We go back to, I think it was chapter 13, the beast got his power from Satan. Well, what was that one purpose that they had? So they had one purpose. Verse 14 tells us the answer. These will wage war against the Lamb, and the Lamb will overcome them, because he's Lord of lords and King of kings, and those who are with him are called the chosen. There's something else I thought. And those who are with him are the called and the called, the chosen, and the faithful, which is Christians. So these 10 kings actually were opposed to two groups. Number one, they were opposed to the Lamb and his followers. But number two, they're also going to be opposed to the woman, the adulteress, the Roman Empire. And you know, evil people hate everybody. They're all in for their own selves. Crooks are not loyal to crooks. This thing about honor among thieves, I don't think that's necessarily true. Two guys steal something from somebody, then one of them shoots the other one so you can have it all instead of splitting it 50-50. So nothing has changed about that. 15. And he said to me, "The waters which you saw, where the harlot sits, are peoples, multitudes, and nations, and tongues." And I think that means all the peoples that the Roman Empire had conquered. Yeah, let's review that again, because that is meaningful, because we go back to Daniel. The waters where the harlot sits represent the peoples, multitudes, so forth of the Roman Empire, which did not form a cohesive group. It was not a unified empire, just like Daniel said it would. In Daniel 2:42, where the toes of the statue would be iron mixed with clay, and they wouldn't combine with each other. So it's not like everybody in the empire was saying, "Oh, we love Rome. Let's be loyal and faithful. Hail Rome." No, they were all in for their own good. All right. Verse 16. "And the 10 horns which you saw," remember that 10 horns goes back to verse 12. The 10 horns are the 10 kings. "The 10 horns which you saw and the beast, these will hate the harlot." So what we have is the empire fighting against itself, which is exactly what happened. You know, symbolically, if you're trying to take that literally, you say, well, that's Rome consuming itself. Yeah, but that's what really happened as the empire deteriorated. And it will be a horrible impact on the empire. They'll make her desolate, naked, eat her flesh, burn her up with fire. So The ten horns are all future rulers. They will, number one, oppose Christ, because they're going to fight the Lamb and his followers. But number two, they're also going to oppose the harlot, which is the Roman Empire at the time of writing. But all future kingdoms that would be associated with the beast are represented there. Rome happened to be the beast of the time. There have been other beasts since then, and there were beasts before that. And not only that, there were harlots before that that were nations. So at the time, the harlot and the beast were inseparable, but the kings and the beast would eventually turn against the empire, which would result in its fall. Okay, now, we didn't really do justice to the last two verses here. Verse 17 says, "For God has put it in their hearts to execute his purpose by having a common purpose." And the interesting thing about that is, God put it in the hearts of the evil kings to have a purpose. Now, the purpose happened to be the same purpose that God had. So what we have going on here is God is using evil people to accomplish his purpose by making his purpose the same as their purpose. Well, what was that common purpose? The destruction of the empire. And it's just like what God did back with Pharaoh. You know, people say, well, it doesn't seem fair that God hardened Pharaoh's heart. That was kind of nasty. Why would God set Pharaoh up to do that? God didn't harden Pharaoh's heart because he said, "Pharaoh, I'm not going to give you a hard heart." He hardened Pharaoh's heart by demanding that he do something that he knew Pharaoh was going to refuse to do. So who hardened Pharaoh's heart? Well, Pharaoh hardened Pharaoh's heart. All God did was provide for him the opportunity to demonstrate his hardened heart. And he does the same thing with these ten kings. It says, God has put it in their hearts to execute his purpose, which is the destruction of Rome, and by giving their kingdom to the beast until the words of God should be fulfilled. So, these ten kings of the future, I'm guessing within two centuries of the time that John is writing, but not born yet, and not kings yet, because the kingdom had not been given to them yet. They gave their kingdom to the beast. Their loyalty was to the devil. They were not interested in doing good. They were not interested in praying and worshiping God. Their loyalty was to the devil. And God used them to destroy Rome. That was the common purpose that they had, until the words of God shall be fulfilled. And that is until God has finished what he's intending to do, and that is destroy Rome. And the woman whom you saw is the great city which reigns over the kings of the earth. Well, we saw that's Babylon was written on her, and that represents Rome. So, let's read my review here. The beast that was given authority by the devil, keep in mind there have been beasts all along as the devil's agent, always evil. The beast will attack the harlot, which was the Roman Empire of the day, make her desolate, naked, eat her flesh, and burn her up with fire. That's a horrible ending. The evil beast would continue to exist in the form of one evil world power after another, but it would destroy the present harlot, which was Rome. So what I'm suggesting is there has been an evil beast as long as the devil has used empires to oppose Christ. In chapter 17, what we have here is this ongoing conflict between the devil and the Lamb. It's been going on ever since Eve. And so the devil has set up one beast after another one. Rome happened to be the beast in the first century. The harlot would eventually be replaced by another harlot, intertwined with the new version of the evil beast. Whatever empire that was that opposed Christ, and we've got him today. Yeah, I'd say probably Russia, probably some of the Middle East kingdoms. Who knows? Anybody else? Well, anybody that says we're going to kill Christians obviously is a beast that's an agent of the devil. The Roman Empire was the specific case during John's time. But the pattern of the devil using the beast to fight the Lamb would be repeated throughout the future. And it's being repeated today. But notice, the loyalty of the evil kings was to the beast not to the woman sitting on atop the beast. A few verses before, it tells us they'd given their authority to the beast. And where'd the beast get his authority when he came out of the abyss? Satan. So it's all evil. And it's almost depressing, except the Bible told us this is what was going to happen. That so many nations oppose Christ and just refuse to honor him as the creator of all things and the savior of all men. Just refuses. But the Bible in the Old Testament, New Testament tells us that's what was going to happen. Broad is the way that leads to destruction. 17. God has put it in their hearts, the hearts of who? The evil kings, to execute his purpose. God knew that the kings already had it in their hearts to do evil because of their yielding to the authority of the beast. Chapter 17, verse 12 tells us. So what God did was, he formed a common purpose with them. He used their desire to do evil to execute his purpose. So they had a common purpose, it says, which was to destroy the Roman Empire. So God and the evil kings had a common purpose, and that's similar, as we talked about, to what God did to Pharaoh in Exodus 9:12, when it says he hardened Pharaoh's heart. God knew that Pharaoh was a stubborn, evil man, and so what he says is, through Moses, let my people go. Pharaoh says, ain't no way. So who hardened Pharaoh's heart? Well, God didn't harden his heart. Pharaoh hardened his own heart. What God did was gave him the opportunity to demonstrate the hardness of his heart. So what this shows is what we've heard in sermons for years, and that is God used wicked nations to avenge judgment on other wicked nations, sometimes on his own people. An example that I gave you here is that God used Babylon to take Judah into captivity for 70 years as a punishment for idolatry. Jeremiah 25, 8 through 11. Well, there was nothing wonderful about Babylon spiritually. It was evil. But what God did was take the evil empire of Babylon and punish Judah with it. And then we see, if you read the rest of that chapter, God also said, after I'm through using Babylon to punish Judah, I'm also going to punish Babylon, which he did. So anyway, that puts us where we are now in chapter 18. And chapter 18 is so much easier than chapter 17. Well, I didn't read this. The woman on the beast was the great city, which is Babylon. Babylon symbolized the Roman Empire, which at the time of John's writing reigned over the kings of the earth, it says. The woman was a harlot who was clothed in purple and scarlet, but she had a cup full of abominations and immorality. It was all deceptive luxury and beauty. She enticed the kings and peoples of the earth to practice idolatry, sexual immorality, worship of man, emperor worship, instead of the one true God, which God has detested ever since man first got the idea to practice idolatry. So beneath this facade of wealth, luxury, and seduction, her true self was revealed. And it says there, in chapter 17, it says she was drunk with the blood of the saints and the blood of the witnesses of Jesus. 17:6. So though she looked luxurious, grandeur, splendor, the whole mess, she was a murderer. Her eventual fate was destruction, with all the things that were described about the nasty things that happened to her. And what would the readers of Revelation in the first century take from that? The readers would be assured that the evil Roman Empire would eventually be brought to justice, and the deaths of the martyrs would be avenged. Remember the question, I think back in chapter 6, how long until our death be avenged? It's going to happen. Now, for the people who were asking, it wasn't going to happen in the next few years. It was going to happen a couple of centuries later, but it was going to happen. Okay. Now, we change time frames here. So I put up here, chapter 17 provided some of the details of the fall of the Roman Empire. It also gave us a little glimpse into this continuing battle between Satan and the Lamb, which of course the Lamb is going to win, Jesus. So in chapter 18, the Roman Empire is being destroyed. The destruction of it is watching. It's burning. Its smoke is coming up. It's falling. It hadn't totally fallen yet, but it's falling. It's being destroyed, and the reaction of those who profited from the empire's existence is described as they watch it fall. And just keep in mind this, as we describe each of the people, the groups of people who profited from the fall of the empire, not from the fall, who profited from the interacting with the empire, they watch the fall of the empire from a distance. They don't offer to help. There's nobody that says, oh, the empire's falling apart. We got to get an army together and save it. No, that wasn't there. It was all selfish. Okay, verse 1, chapter 18. After these things, I saw another angel coming down from heaven, having great authority, and the earth was illumined with his glory. So, after these things doesn't tell us any specific time period. It just indicates it's a continuation of the sequence of the revelation. But it says he had great authority. So what he was about to say was important. And it was also going to have an impact on the earth, a huge impact on the earth. Because it says the earth was illuminated. So what the angel is about to tell John says, this is a big deal. And it's really going to impact the whole known world at the time, because it's going to impact the whole Roman Empire. Verse 2, he cried out with a mighty voice, which suggests authoritative, and says this. And notice that this is in the past present tense, which suggests in English that this event has already occurred. Okay, now it has not already occurred, but what the angel is doing is predicting that it's going to occur. And if God says something is going to occur, it's as good as if it happened. So that's why it's said like this. Because what we see in the rest of the chapter is people who are profiting from being part of the empire were watching it fall. They were watching it from a distance. They watched the smoke rise up out of the empire. So it's not like it had totally fallen yet, but it's the angel saying it's going to. Fallen, fallen is Babylon the Great, and she has become a dwelling place. And look what's going to happen to it. All this glory and splendor and all this stuff, she's become a dwelling place of demons, a prison of every unclean spirit, a prison of every unclean and hateful bird. A nasty place to be avoided. So when God says something's going to happen, it's as good as done. It's going to happen. So this once glorious city is going to become a really nasty place for demons, unclean spirits, and every unclean and hateful bird. And I just picture birds that are flying around eating dead things and dropping droplets all over the place that make it a nasty place. Now we have three groups that are mentioned in verse 3. For all the nations have drunk of the wine of the passion of her immorality. That's one of them, all the nations. Second group, the kings of the earth have committed acts of immorality. And the third group is the merchants of the earth have become rich by the wealth of her sensuality. So the Greek in this is interesting. The three groups are mentioned. First of all, the nations. That symbolizes all the nations that participate in idolatry, emperor worship, sensual immorality, and all that. All the crumminess of the Roman Empire. The nations that participated in that. And said, yeah. What do you want us to say? You want to know where's the emperor? Make an idol of the emperor and worship that thing? Okay, we'll do that. Just keep on giving us the money. The literal translation there is, they drank the wine of the fury of her fornication. So, interesting play on words that God uses here. The wine that was initially sensually enticing became the wine of God's fury. And remember what the harlot had in her gold cup? Abominations. It looked like really enticing stuff. But it turns out it was the wrath of God. The kings of the earth symbolized the rulers of the evil nations that interacted with Rome for selfish political and economic gain. We'll play along. How many politicians do you know that you say, man, they are men of integrity or women of integrity? Well, even today, very few. But they didn't have any back then either. The merchants of the earth is the third group. That refers to merchants who got rich by trading within the empire. And literally, if you look at the interlinear translation of this, it says they got rich by the wealth of her sensuality or through the power of her luxury. You know, some people who are rich who are really tight with their money, and that's how they got rich. But other people who are rich don't give a second thought to wasting money on all kinds of silly stuff. And they don't miss it because they got millions more. Where that came from. So it talks about here they got rich, the Barry interlinear Greek says, through the power of her luxury. When you're so wealthy and you have so much luxury that you don't miss the money, you're ready to waste money on stuff you don't need. Okay, 4. And I heard another voice from heaven saying, come out of her, my people, that you may not participate in her sins, and that you may not receive of her plagues. So there's another voice that comes out of heaven, and this voice is speaking specifically to Christians. And it's a warning. The voice from heaven encouraged Christians not to participate in the evil that characterized the Romans. Literally, the Greek says that they not have fellowship in her sins. That's the way the Little Greek translation says. So what does that mean? Well, by refusing to participate, and you know there was peer pressure to participate. Well, we feel it today. There's peer pressure to sin. All kinds of stuff, especially if you're spending too much time with the wrong kind of people. But by refusing to participate, Christians would be spared the wrath to come. And that's what he's saying. Verse 5. For her sins have piled up as high as heaven, and God has remembered her iniquities. Remember, we're talking symbolic language. But the sins of Babylon, the Roman Empire, were so plentiful that they symbolically piled up to heaven. Now, how high is that? Well, pretty high. God, and it says, now this is sobering. This is sobering even today, I think. It says, and God has remembered her iniquities. Whoa. So somewhere, there is a book, which in our terms today, in accounting terms, we call a ledger. And it's keeping track of everything that everybody does. And this one says, God remembered her iniquities. And he's still remembering. And he's still keeping track. And that ought to sober us to try hard to have all the right things in that book. 6 brings up something that somebody says, well, I didn't know that people could be double paid for their sins. And there's nothing in the Bible that says that. But I think what this is talking about here in verse 6 is the harshness of the judgment of the empire. Pay her back even as she has paid, and give back to her double according to her deeds. In the cup which she has mixed, mix twice as much for her. So the harlot had this gold cup full of filth, poison, abomination, sin, all that kind of stuff. And as much of that as the harlot Rome was dishing out, she's going to have to drink twice that much in retribution. Remember, the book is full of symbols. So there's no passage in the New Testament, or the Old Testament for that matter, that makes us think that if you sin real bad, you're going to get worse punishment. I mean, I don't want to be in the mild form of hell, or the moderate form of hell, or the nasty part of hell. Just being in hell would be bad enough. I'll take being in the mild form of heaven. I'll tell you that. Okay, 7. Now we have a description of the arrogance of Rome. It says, to the degree that she glorified herself and lived sensuously, to the same degree give her torment and mourning. In other words, let's take the level of arrogance that Rome maintains. We are infallible. We are wonderful. We're never going to fall. Ooh, does that sound familiar? And let's make what she suffers just the same degree as the arrogance that she claimed. Very interesting. To the degree that she glorified herself and lived sensuously, to the same degree give her torment and mourning. For she says in her heart, I sit as a queen, and I'm not a widow, and will never see mourning. In other words, I'm a queen with no problems. When somebody dies, the widow is usually sad, depressed, and mourns. She says, that's not me. My life is full of happiness and wonderful things. Rome glorified herself and lived sensuously, luxuriously, is the translation. Bragging that she's a queen, not a widow, and will never mourn. But it says she'll be tormented and will mourn to the same degree that she glorified herself. An extreme degree. What John heard here, and it, obviously the Bible was written and inspired by God from Genesis on through Revelation. So God can go back and use his own examples as the inspired word unfolds. But what John heard is probably based on what Isaiah said back in chapter 47, verses 7 through 9, about ancient, ready for this, Babylon. So the symbolism of Rome representing ancient Babylon is just really simple to see. But what Isaiah said about the real Babylon, geographically, historically, that existed, was this in Isaiah 47. In one day, the loss of children and widowhood shall come on you in full measure in spite of your many sorceries. So you see the comparison between historical Babylon and historical Rome? And do you also see what God said was going to happen to both of them? And he made sure that it did. And it happened fast. Old Babylon fell pretty fast. Says in one day, you're going to have loss of children. What's that called? Well, one of the worst things somebody can experience is the death of a child. And it also says you're going to have widowhood. One of the worst things a woman who's had a happy marriage for 40 years can experience is the death of her husband. Results in mourning. And he says, that's going to come upon you in spite of your many sorceries. Same thing with Rome. Okay, verse 8. For this reason, in one day her plagues will come. We're talking about Rome now. For this reason, notice back in chapter, in verse 7, he said to ancient Babylon is going to happen in one day. Now here he is talking about Rome. For this reason, in one day, her plagues will come. And we read about the plagues a few chapters ago. Will come. There'll be pestilence. And that's literally translated, if you look on your footnote in the New American Standard, that's literally translated death, and mourning, and famine, and she will be burned up with fire, for the Lord God who judges her is strong. And what did she say she wasn't going to suffer? No mourning, no sadness. I'm a queen. What could possibly go wrong? And in verse 8, God says, I'll show you what could go wrong. So, for this reason, what reason? That's pride, Rome's pride and sensuous living. And then in one day, we know Rome did not fall in one day. It took a while. But in one day is symbolically indicating that the plagues will come upon the empire suddenly. That's very interesting to notice here that he says that Rome will suffer plagues, pestilence, death, mourning, and famine. And in the year 250 AD, there really was a plague that came in ancient Rome and killed millions of people. In 250 AD. And if Revelation was written like we thought, like I think it was, in 96 or so, that took, a century and a half before this happened. But when he's prophesying that they'll suffer plagues, pestilence, death, mourning, and all that sort of thing, and at 250 AD there was a plague that killed millions of people, that seems like a prophecy coming true. Rome would be burned up with fire, maybe by the kings that we read about in chapter 17, and the once luxurious lifestyle will be reduced to famine. And all this arrogant pride, we are strong, powerful, and will last forever, were pitiful words that they had to eat. All right, 9. Now let's read 9 and 10, because 9 and 10 tell us about the kings of the earth. The kings of the earth who committed acts of immorality and lived sensuously with her will weep and lament over her when they see the smoke of her burning. And notice this, standing at a distance. Nobody rushing to help, nobody rushing to put out the fire. Standing at a distance, why at a distance? Because of the fear of her torment. I don't want to get caught in that. So I'm going to keep my distance, saying, "Whoa, whoa, the great city." Well, that's fake sympathy. They're saying, "Whoa," they're saying the right things, but with no sincerity. The great city, Babylon, the strong city, for in 1 hour your judgment has come. Now in verse 8 it says it happened in 1 day, and in verse 10 it says it comes in 1 hour. Both of that symbolic language for saying that Babylon is going to fall, and the fall is going to be a crash, and it's going to happen pretty fast. Now did Babylon fall in 1 hour? No. Did Babylon fall in 1 day? No. But Babylon fell pretty fast. The kings, rulers of countries who participated in Rome's sensuous and luxurious lifestyle will weep and lament when they see the smoke of her burning. Why are they weeping and lamenting? Because it's over. The rich hand that was dishing out money hand over fist, it is no longer doing that. The kings watch from a distance, fearful that they'll get caught up in the destruction, and with purely selfish concerns, they fake grief by saying, "Whoa, whoa," but from a distance, with no offer to help. They marvel that the once powerful empire falls so fast, symbolically in 1 hour. It's similar to what God said of ancient Babylon back in Jeremiah 50 and 31, when he said about ancient Babylon, "Behold, I am against you, O arrogant one, for your day has come, the time when I shall punish you." He said the same thing about ancient historical Babylon that he's saying now about symbolic Babylon, the Roman Empire. Now we shift to another group of people, which is merchants. So let's read 11 through 13. The merchants of the earth weep and mourn over her because no one buys their cargoes anymore. Notice what it doesn't say. It doesn't say the merchants weep and mourn at the destruction of the city or the death of all these poor people or the fact that their economy is ruined or anything like that. No, it says that they weep because no one buys their cargoes anymore. There's no buyers from a product. I'm really sad about that. Or you sad because the empire is falling and all these people are dying? No. Well, yeah, that's a shame. But what I'm really sad about is I can't sell anything to anybody anymore. Wow. Does that attitude still exist, do you think? Oh, I'm afraid it does. It's part of the human condition. All right, 12 and 13 list the things that are no longer available. Cargoes of gold and silver and precious stones and pearls and fine linen and purple and silk and scarlet and every kind of citron wood and every article of ivory and every article made from very costly wood and bronze and iron and marble. In other words, all the expensive, luxurious stuff. 13. And cinnamon and spice and incense and perfume and frankincense and wine and olive oil and fine flour and wheat and cattle and sheep. Does that thing ring after 10 minutes? Has to. Sheep, cargoes of horses, chariots, and then, very interesting to me, is slaves and human lives. So most of the things that are mentioned in verse 13 are things that were imported. You know, we're kind of spoiled now. In January, I can go into Publix and buy strawberries. Now, they're two or three times the price they ought to be, but they're shipped in from California or South Florida or somewhere. So we don't really appreciate this, but there was a time, I remember when I was really little, there was a time when you couldn't get fresh fruit in January, February, and March because you just couldn't get it. It wasn't available. Well, in Rome, they were used to getting all this good stuff imported whenever they felt like it because they had the money to pay for it. And they had the merchants to go get it from wherever it is it was grown and bring it. But to me, what I find very interesting is this last thing here, the slaves and human lives. In the Roman Empire, what they would do when they captured other nations was they would take the strong men, and I guess strong women, and use them as slaves, and they were actually traded as commodities. What a value for human life that is. Literally, when you look at it, let's look at verse down at the bottom of this overhead. Rome used people from captured land as slaves, and Barry translates that in the Greek literally as slaves and souls of men. Now you talk about devaluing human life. That's it. They captured and traded slaves and souls of men. Well, it's really not fair to separate this guy from his family and take him to another place and sell him as a slave. Fair? Who cares? Slaves and souls of men. 14. The fruit you long for has gone from you, and all things that were luxurious and splendid have passed away from you, and men will no longer find them. That's exotic imported fruits. 15. The merchants of these kings who became rich from her will stand at a distance because of the fear of her torment, weeping and mourning, saying, "Woe, woe, the great city, who was clothed in fine linen and purple and scarlet and adorned with gold and precious stones and pearls, for in 1 hour such great wealth has been laid waste. And every shipmaster and every passenger and sailor and as many as make their living by the sea stood at a distance and were crying out as they saw the smoke of her burning, saying, what city is like the great city?" In other words, saying, how could this possibly come to pass? How could such greatness turn into such a mess? Well, we'll take up with verse 19 next week. Appreciate your attention.